The Future of Teamwork is a Leader production. Subscribe today and never miss an episode.
Leadership isn't a right. It's a privilege. It's an honor. It's a responsibility. And too many people are appointed into or race into leadership without understanding the responsibility we have when we lead.
Welcome to The Future of Teamwork. My name's Dane Grunewald, and today I'm joined by Meeta Malik. The last time Meeta and I were talking, we were on stage in Las Vegas at the Transform Conference talking about her new book, which is just released, The Devil Emails at Midnight. And she's the author of Reimagine Inclusion as well. And it's just been so much fun getting to know you, Meeta. I'm excited to dive into another conversation today.
Yeah, no, thanks so much. I was just reminiscing with you that you were one of the first early readers of The Devil Emails at Midnight, What Good Leaders Can Learn from Bad Bosses. And so that means a lot that you took the time to read it early on and we talked about it on stage at Transform. So thank you.
Oh, super good. Captivating in the title and every story along the way. So we'll dive into that today. For the benefit of our listeners who don't know you as well as I do, maybe you could give us a quick background of like how you came to be doing all of this cool work.
Well, my background is I'm on a mission to fix what's broken in our workplaces. That's from my own experiences and other people's experiences. I've been both a marketing executive and a human resources executive. You know, we spend a lot of time thinking about how much we're going to sell whom, where, what, why to externally, but our employees are often our forgotten consumers. And so halfway through my career, I shifted into that thinking. I'm a Wall Street Journal, USA Today bestselling author. I love a good story. I love telling a good story. I love reading a good story. And the most important thing I'm trying to do right now is raise kind and inclusive human beings. I'm sure every generation of parents said that, but Dane, hard. It's a hard time to be doing it right now.
It's really hard. Yeah, it is. It's fascinating. Just the power of story right now. We're talking about that pre-show, but I think everyone's overwhelmed. It's certainly my lived experience. A lot of people that I speak to in different places of society are just feeling like, wow, there's so much load coming on us, whether it's life, whether it's information, whether it's change. Yes. And story just seems to have this way, this essence of like captivating us and pulling us into the real moment.
Yeah, absolutely. And so you won't be surprised to hear that nonfiction sales are down. Mm-hmm. Fiction sales are skyrocketing for exactly what you said. Yeah. You know, for me personally, I feel exhausted by being outraged all the time. I'm overwhelmed by information. I'm heartbroken of all the things happening across the world to different communities and hurt and harm, either man-made or natural disasters. Yeah, it's and we have access to so much of it in a way we didn't.
Yes.
And so many people are looking for community and conversation, and storytelling is one of the oldest forms of communication in human civilization. And so I think we're all going back to that natural instinct of wanting to gather around a campfire and tell a good story, hear a good story, and connect.
It's real. And I like the way you pick on community and conversation. So how are you seeing whether it's through your own work or work that you're seeing done in organizations that are building better workplaces, that there's a way of building community and that almost connection by inference, I guess, through these stories?
Well, you don't have community without connection. Mm-hmm. So people who are trying to build communities, I have a very large following on LinkedIn, and people will say, well, how is it so engaged? Like you're following. I'm like, it's not a following, it's a community.
Yes.
I try to treat everybody, unless you have a picture of nothing and you have a picture of like your pet.
Yeah.
I like assume everyone is like an individual person. I don't assume they're a bot.
Yes.
So if you've taken the time to comment or you've taken the time to ask me a question, I respond. I don't have a virtual assistant. I'm not part of paid pods. I'm actually really interested in what you have to say and your insights about something I've posted. And it gives me more ideas for other things we should be fixing and thinking about and writing about. So it's interesting. There's a difference between following and community. Mm. And it's all about connection. That's when you have a community. And so how do you connect? You connect by helping each other, by paying it forward, by listening, by sharing stories, by sharing advice, by sharing a shoulder to cry on, by offering my ear to listen, all those things. And that's what I think people miss the point about what community is and why, when communities thrive and when they don't.
I love that. So I guess that's a great segue to jump into the role of leaders, because in some ways, leaders are creating communities, at least in their teams and in their organizations. And one of the captivating data points that I think you shared in the book was around just the damage that a bad leader can have on you know, a team member or a group of team members in terms of mental health and energy. Yes. So maybe we can start there and then get into some of the stories.
Yeah, there was a recent study I was not able to include in my book, but I did talk about this in my book. Another recent study said that 2/3 of individuals say, Dane, that their manager has the most impact on their mental health.
Yeah.
More than their doctor, therapist, spouse, children. And you're like, what? And you sit with that and you're like, yeah, I feel that. That's right. That's actually right. Right. Because when it's bad, it's bad. And when it's good, it's good. And that's the power bosses have over us. And when you think about, I liked what you said about, we're talking about the community conversation piece. Too many leaders, I think, assume that a team is a community. It's not. You have to take time, right? And that's like, leadership isn't a right. It's a privilege. It's an honor. It's a responsibility. And too many people are appointed into or race into leadership without understanding the responsibility we have when we lead.
Yeah. That's what I think I enjoyed about getting into the book when I got to read it, was the way that you've positioned the bad bosses, because it's so like, oh, gripping. I've had that experience. Or, oh my gosh, have I done that to somebody before?
Yes.
And then use that as a role model to say, it's the anti-role model, isn't it? Hey, this is what not to do. Here's where you can build around that.
Yeah, I mean, listen, the whole book, the premise is that, you know, the opening line is, I've been a bad boss and chances are so have you. And it's a swing of a pendulum. You can be a bad boss and be a good leader. You can be a bad boss. And it goes and ebbs and flows depending on what's happening in our personal lives and our careers. I had a bad boss moment this morning. I just micromanaged something. And after I sent it, I was like, I didn't need to be the first one to respond to that.
Yes.
Why did I do that? And then I was like, oh, you know, so we all catch ourselves. And as we talked about, my notorious behavior is micromanagement. And I'm sorry, I'm sure someone a long time ago worked for me and said I was micromanaging Mita, which is true, or they had another clever nickname for me. But if we can be aware of what that behavior is and how it swings, I think that's so important.
It's also so important right now that leaders are realizing that they're parts and not a whole. So, you know, a part of me was a really bad boss today, but a part of me was a good boss. Yeah. And I can't let one offset the other. I've got to honor every part along the way, because different employees are going to have different experiences with me.
Yeah. And we talked about this earlier too, is that, you know, context and situation matters. So somebody could be a bad boss for me, but a good boss for you. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
How you like receive how that person leads, or they might be micromanaging me. And you know, the irony is I hate to be micromanaged. There's nothing like killing the joy out of work than micromanaging for me. And yet I will micromanage people. So this boss could be micromanaging for me, but you're a new employee, perhaps you're earlier in your career, and you actually do need that level of not micromanagement, handholding, support, right? See how we can reframe those things. And then all of a sudden, well, that's actually a good boss for you. And so that matters as we think about relationships.
That's interesting. So I've got this visual picture there, Mita, about, hey, this team member is going to have a better experience with this leader than this one. So from below, that makes a lot of sense. I wonder what it looks like from above. Like, how do bosses and managers once removed, twice removed, understand the role that leaders underneath them are playing? Because, you know, I might like someone who's very like visionary and ideas driven, because that's how I drive energy. And so I'll be thinking, oh, that's a great leader right there that's running that team over there. And yet the team members below them might be sitting there going, oh my gosh, this boss just keeps introducing chaos every day. Like, can't he just let us get on with our job?
Yeah. I mean, listen, this is the art of leadership, is that if you work for me, I'm not going to become you and you're not going to become me, but I'm going to try to meet you halfway. And I do think that's really important when you're building a team, when you're onboarding people, that you talk about the ways in which you like to work. What have been your pitfalls? What are you working on, right? And I wish there was more vulnerability like that in the workplace. You know, every time I've started in a new company, or let's say a new CEO's come or a new vice president, they usually do the roadshow. they'll have pictures of their family and where they like to vacation. And here's a little bit about me and here's what I've done in my career. But how many of them are willing to say, here's what I'm really good at and here's what I'm working on and here's what I'd like your help on working on? Like, you never, I don't think I've ever, I can't, I'm going through years now of thinking about this. This is a really good thing for me. I don't think I've ever had a leader who's starting a new team or building a new team ever say, this is something I'm working on vulnerably. I want your help. Like, doesn't that already set the tone?
Oh,
you're like,
hugely.
Wow, I want to work for this person. Like, Dane's being honest. He's up there saying, here, lead this new division. And here's what I need your help with. Here's what I need to work on. And I need you to hold me accountable. Not what the business needs. We need to grow double digits. No, no. Dane is actually being vulnerable and saying, here's something he needs to work on as a leader. I wish we saw more of that.
We could spend the next couple of hours talking about this point. This one's huge. I've had some really interesting conversations with guests in the past on this, and you know, everything from user manuals, which some organizations do use, maybe not for the incoming CEO, but it's kind of like, hey, here's how I work. This is what drains me. This is where my blind spots are. So that kind of thing is cool. I'm hearing some of that there. But the other one that's landing with me is, I had a guest on the show the other day and they said, can we please stop having leaders come into new teams and lay out their 90-day plan?
Oh, gosh.
It's a disaster.
You're like, you haven't even listened to me. You don't even know what's working, what's not working. You're just coming in to be like, I'm going to fix it all. Here's the magic wand. How do you think it makes the team feel who's been there committed to doing the work?
Or have had that idea before and have never,
And it hasn't worked or whatever the case may be. It's just... oof, been there too.
It's heavy. It's interesting. There was one conversation we had about a year ago where there was an organization that very intentionally gave incoming leaders a 6-week handoff process with the outgoing leader. So that was a large organization that was moving a lot of people. And so that kind of shadowing period was awesome because you got to go around and have the leader talk you through, this is my experience with this person and here's where we're at on this project. And it's so infrequent that we really get to onboard properly into teams as leaders.
And that is when bad boss behavior will start too, or perceived bad boss. Well, the boss was never set up for success.
Yeah.
And, you know, bad boss behavior always generally shows up when there's some kind of stress. Something is being stressed and that's when we're not at our best. But if you haven't set the leader up for success, then that's when those behaviors will show up.
That's a key point to kind of double click on, that the stress brings out the bad boss behavior, even in good leaders. They're going to have that moment.
Yes.
We had Sabina Nawaz on the show recently, and she shared her story from being at Microsoft and coming back from maternity leave and just being in this pressure cooker. I think Steve Ballmer called her into the office and she all of a sudden clicked into bad boss mode for a number of weeks and had an employee crying, and she was just like, oh, wow, this just all of a sudden happened to me. So I think it's a good maybe warning light on the dashboard to say, hey, if the pressure's on, maybe you do have to take that breath. Maybe you do need to go and ask someone, hey, how am I showing up right now?
Yeah. And what you just summarized is one of the three moments when we'll see bad boss behavior showing up. I mean, one moment is there's something happening in the marketplace that's impacting your business. We're sitting in the US right now, lots of conversations around tariffs, right? Something's happening that's creating stress, bad boss behavior. Number two, in my house, we say poo-poo trickles down. I don't use the S word, so bad boss behavior trickles down. Dane works for me, first-time leader. I'm exhibiting bad boss behavior. He just starts absorbing those behaviors, doesn't know any better, doesn't realize. And then the third is something personal has happened. You just mentioned the guest who is coming back from leave. I don't know if that was part of it or the environment at work, but you have changes in your life. It can also be a personal earthquake. You lose someone you love, a miscarriage, a divorce, breakup, move, illness, you know, all these things. And you think you can compartmentalize it and just shove it in a drawer at home and then show up to work. It doesn't work like that.
No.
And so those are moments where these behaviors, because there's stress, some stress is happening and the behaviors are going to show up.
Yeah. No, it's really interesting. I think we've built so much of our HR infrastructure in workplaces around the individual. How do we hire them? What are they going to do? How are they performing? Where are they going career development wise? But it's so like myopic. We're not thinking about some of those other moments. What's their relationship with the boss? What just happened in the market? What might have happened at home?
I wish, you know, I want more companies to hold me accountable as a leader during my performance review time to say, you're responsible for attrition. You can tell me a story of why all these five people left over the last month.
Yeah.
Ultimately, it's your team. You're responsible for promotion rates.
Yes.
You know, you're responsible for the health of your team and those metrics, because too often it is just the revenue target, which is important. We're all here to make money. We're running a business, right?
Yeah.
But then what about the part of what's happening with the team? That's so important. It's the what and the how. How did you get to the double-digit growth? What did you do to get there? Can we talk about that part, please?
You're right. Because we've over-indexed for too long on the outcome and not the method.
Well, and the, you know, and it's all coming from the same P&L, which is really interesting. So, you know, I might have gotten that double-digit growth. I work for Dane. I've double-digit growth. Oh my God, Mita's getting like a gazillion-dollar bonus and an amazing rating and all this stuff because she turned this division around. She also lost like 15 people on her team this quarter.
Yeah.
No one's talking about that and the cost to replace those people, which is 2.5 times. Like, you know, so there's cost to these things that we're not talking about, which is so interesting. But we're focused on that one number. Oh, she beat the target. But it's like, well, what did it cost her to do that?
Oh, yeah.
What did we lose in the process?
I must admit, there's something that reflection helps on there, maybe after the events. Like, I've been through some huge growth moments in different organizations in my career. And at the time, you're like, wow, we're grinding, we're winning, we're celebrating big results, we're celebrating promotions. But if you go a couple of years forwards and you're out of the moment, and you just sit and reflect and you think about some of the human damage that was spread out in the trail behind you. And it's not because people were unable to perform.
Sure.
And it's not because the business outgrew them. It's largely because we haven't actually taken the time to really think about the team dynamics. And so, you know, the team gets carried by a lot of individuals and a lot of behaviors show up that aren't really good or sustainable or healthy.
It's true.
So, I really like that concept of holding leaders accountable then for their attrition rates, their promotions, possibly even for like what innovation has come from your team.
Absolutely. There's so many things. You could think of a dashboard. Like, you think about all these things, right? And you're back to your point on like for too long, our workplaces have been really constructed around individual performance, right? Versus, it's really interesting. And then I've never gone into a performance review where it's about a we. It's never the we.
Yeah.
It's the I. And yet, you know, we're driving the we, but then very quickly when you go into those it's individual when we go into those performance review conversations.
Yeah, we spoke to a chief people officer of a very entrepreneurial and innovative biotech business the other day, and she shared that healthy teams are very much a center of focus for them in driving these, you know, huge feats as they bring out new drugs and discover new drugs. But what was interesting is when we talked about team performance reviews, she paused and she said, that would be excellent. It can't be an or, it has to be an and. And the other interesting thing I thought for any listeners that want to go and play with it is she suggested, well, people are rarely on one team. So you probably have to be quite intentional about in this review cycle, it's this we, however you construct it.
It's true. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, listen, if I can rate my Uber driver, I'd love to be able to rate my boss. My team should be able to rate me. So imagine a system where lots of people are feeding in to these ratings with lots of interesting insights and feedback. Of course, it has to be done with care, and you have to upskill people on how to give feedback.
Yeah.
With the, as Brené Brown would say, kind and clear.
Yes.
But it's just really interesting to think about that and sort of how we can give people more a holistic view of how they're performing.
Yeah. That would be cool. I'd love to see more of that.
Yeah.
Let's get into a couple of the bad bosses, because I'd love for listeners who haven't experienced the book to get a little bit of a taste. There were some great titles that you gave to these bosses in the books. I wonder if there's one that jumps off the page right now that you'd like to kind of dive into as a bit of an explanation.
Well, I think we talked about her on stage, Medusa. That's the one that I still, to this day, we could talk about this one for hours, but I just shared earlier with you that no one in my life had ever screamed at me, not my parents, not my husband, not my brother, not friends. I mean, I'm guilty now as a parent of screaming sometimes at my kids.
Me too.
But I never, there's no screaming that I grew up with. And then I am forced to work for this person in this very large company who all she does is screams and yells, publicly humiliates, privately humiliates. A really interesting bully boss who does not, is an equal opportunity bully. So not signaling out people, just mm-hmm. goes after everybody, mm-hmm. throws tantrums like a toddler, throws pens, throws a Chanel shoe at a colleague, true story. And you're just like, what is happening? But what's interesting about this, I keep thinking about this because I know that someone listening is experiencing this or going through this today. And you're like, how does this continue to happen? Because we continue to believe, and it's true, that fear drives short-term results. It does. I showed up to work scared every day working for her. And that fear and that adrenaline rush drove me to exceed expectations. And I thought by doing that, she would lay off me. It didn't matter. She would still come after me. So then it's like if a black bear shows up in your backyard, I live in the East Coast, right? And that sort of visceral reaction you have. Now imagine that feeling every day at work. You just can't, your body gets exhausted from it. And so I was tired of being scared. And then I thought to myself, it doesn't matter what I do because she'll come after me anyways. And that's when the productivity decreases. You go underneath the radar. It's what I call like, you're this flame, but it starts to flicker. The light is going out because you're headed toward being disengaged and then toward burnout. And so that's what I don't understand to this day, why leaders don't understand that fear is going to kill culture in the long term. It just will.
Yep.
And then, but it drives short-term results. So it's very appealing. Like for this individual, Medusa, she ran a team of 12 people at one point, and within 16 months, all those people left. And then they removed her to run another team, which was the team I had to be on. And then what happened there? Again, after 16, 17 months, everyone left that team.
It's fascinating. It's fascinating that there's a similar time frame too, that like humans can put up with so much for so long.
Yes.
I love that flickering flame analogy. You know, corporations all too often, I've been one of those leaders, will say, hey, I love this burning platform. But actually, you know, in a burning platform moment, whether it's a competitor's launched a new product or in a market downturn or whatever, you're totally driving through fear.
You are. Yeah. And the question is how long? Because, you know, stress, there are different kinds of stress, and stress can help you in the short term drive results.
Yeah.
And you can harness it positively, but it's the perpetual state of fear that's not going to work.
No.
Right? It's not going to work.
Correct. And you mentioned sort of disengagement and burnout.
Yeah.
One of my favorite descriptions of creating a positive organization comes from a friend, Ian McDonald, who did a lot of work on systems leadership theory. And he talks about work is really turning intent into reality. So as a team, that's what we want to do. Yeah. And to do that, you want to create an environment where each team member comes to work and willingly gives of their best, because that's the best way to get the energy and get the innovation. Yeah. And that's not happening when you're cranking through people like that.
Yeah. Absolutely.
So with Medusa then, I know the other great thing about your book and these stories is you share the story. There's that visceral sort of emotion experience.
Yeah.
But then you provide some framing of like, here's what you can do when you deal with a boss like this. So for any listeners out there that are either worried about being that boss or have that boss, what are some of the approaches that you can have to managing yourself through that situation?
I think that if you are somebody who loses their temper at work, who shouts and screams, there's probably some self-work and honestly therapy that you need. You know, no more mandating an executive coach. It's therapy.
Yeah.
And so I think that there's that piece. And you know, this is the question, Dane. How many of us have the courage to sit in silence with ourselves and have that discussion with self?
Yeah.
Most of us know when we're behaving badly. I'm embarrassed to say I've yelled at people at work. I know that. I've done it.
Me too.
But how many of us are going to sit there and say, yes, we're doing it. Yes, we're repeatedly doing it. And we want to change it. That's the difference, right? And so I think that's really important. I also want to talk about when we're seeing this behavior at work, you brought this up, you're a leader overseeing a boss who has a team.
Yep.
And so you're a VP of a division and you have many leaders with many teams and you see Meta behaving this way. Are you going to look the other way? Are you going to tolerate it? This is what I see happen too much. Too many excuses are made for Meta.
Yeah.
Because she is a idea generator, revenue producer. She's been at the company since it was founded and started. People make a big deal out of her style. She drives results. People are being too sensitive. Get over it. You haven't really worked for a bad boss. Meta is nothing compared to what I've had to experience. So that is, how do you hold people accountable back to the, it's not just about the number that you're reaching. It's like, how do you go about it?
Yeah.
Right. And I think that's really important. And I wish in our organizations, we actually rewarded more talent attractors, meaning that like, you know, I am somebody who's striving to be the opposite of Medusa. So I'm in service of my team. I'm that leader who's trying to create more leaders. And when I do that and people know what kind of a leader I am or you are, you won't have trouble filling seats. No. You're not going to, I've watched this. You're not going to have to go to recruiting. People are just going to flock to Dane's team.
Yeah.
There's an opening and everybody wants on it. Right. And so why don't we actually reward that behavior more?
It's right? a great
it's so
point.
Interesting. Yeah.
It's so interesting. And there's some great books out there that talk about hiring A players, and it's all about bench management and building your reputation as a leader.
Yes.
Because if you build your reputation as a leader, your team members are referring people. People on other teams are referring people. Like you're a magnet.
You've moved from one company to another, and then so you have the Medusa, and what's the opposite?
Yes.
Is someone like Dane who's just attracting talent.
Yeah.
Because the Medusa is like, nobody wants to work for her. I'll never forget, Dane, when I worked for her, I had messages in LinkedIn from other people who had worked for another company warning me, like, what a known brand, right?
Yeah.
And so you could actually have, let's talk about the opposite of that.
Yeah.
Did you hear that Dane has an opening on his team? He's now at this company. You should really go talk to him. He's building his team there. Like, wow. And what an asset to the company.
Yeah.
You know, recruiters don't have to like run around trying to find people. It's like, we already, people are coming.
100%.
Out of woodwork, this
role. And again, for listeners that are looking to innovate right now, that's a far easier measure and intervention than starting to do team performance reviews because there's ways to track it.
Yes.
That's super cool. I really like that. I like it a lot. You also mentioned a great point there, Meta, about, hey, let's not mandate an executive coach. I was talking to one of my friends who's an executive coach the other day, and he was a little bit down. And I was like, Andrew, what's going on? And he goes, you know, I love executive coaching. He said, it's just sad that 50% of my engagements will often come from a performance management issue rather than unlocking potential.
I've worked in companies where I have been the coach on demand for executives, and I've been mandated to coach one toxic leader after another. And I am not a therapist. I'm not. I know my limitations. And so you're like, this is just you're weaponizing executive coaching, right? And then these people will say it doesn't work. It's like, well, you're not using it for the right reasons. And like, it is beyond my scope of what I can help you. Like, I know what I'm good at and I know what I'm not good at. I'm not a therapist. And so do we have the courage to say that? When you asked me about like, you know, what is it that people need to do? And I'm thinking to myself, like hurt people. Mm-hmm. And if something's happening in your life that's causing you to react this way and lash out at your team, you need to seek professional help. And do you have the courage to admit that to yourself and then ask for help?
Yeah. No, I think that's a big one that more and more leaders need to be thinking about is, encourage is a great word. You've used that a couple of times. As a leader, we've traditionally been told to stay on the fence and not get involved in the personal side. But if the hurt people are hurting people, you only have two options. You either address it and suggest they go and do the self-work, or they're not going to stay in your organization. So it's
And I think post-pandemic, the really good leaders know that. We can't separate home from work anymore.
Yeah.
And that doesn't mean every time we talk, there's a massive therapy session at work. That's not what I'm saying.
No.
But I'm saying this idea of courage and vulnerability. I think good leaders get that and know that. I also wanted to talk about that, you know, we talked about like bad bosses aren't born, they're made. And also, how does a Medusa come to be? I think that some industries are exceptional at creating bad bosses. And what I mean by that is whether it's beauty or Hollywood or if we were to name X tech brand right now,
yeah,
where everybody wants to work there and there's like this charismatic cult leader figure. I mean, I'll call out WeWork back in the day. I wanted to work at WeWork. Now we crashed, but it's a scarcity mindset. And it's like, Mita, if you're not going to put up with this behavior, there's 10 other people who will take this job. And so it creates this environment where the behavior actually thrives.
Yes.
Right. And so that's interesting too. And, you know, you look at these people will ask me, like, what do you think about this company? And what do you think about this company? And so you can do case studies, you can talk to leaders as you do, you can do research, you can have people on your podcast, but until you've worked at that company, you don't know.
Yes.
You know, you don't know. It's like, what's going on behind the screen? You don't know. So I'm always very careful to say, here's what I've heard, here's what I've studied, here's what I've researched, but I haven't worked there.
Yeah.
You have to talk to people who are working there now.
Yeah.
Does it match their social media?
Correct. It does make you wonder, you know, way back early 2000s, we were putting a lot of time into employee branding.
Yes.
And that kind of had its life cycle. But now with technology the way it is, you wonder why we're not seeing more honesty coming from employees to prospective employees in the kind of hiring onboarding process. Because there are a lot of people, and even like you said, former employees that are emailing you, like there's so much information available. You would think you'd be able to profile fairly well, not just the company culture, but the leader that you're going to go and work for.
I mean, listen, if you're not managing your employer brand, it's being managed for you.
Yeah, true.
On Glassdoor, on Fishbowl. Yeah. I'll never forget covering Kanye West and Adidas and his anti-Semitic, anti-Black, lots of things happening there in terms of hateful speech and Adidas taking a very long time to cut ties. And I remember researching and employees on LinkedIn coming out and saying, I work at Adidas and I am shocked that this is happening and they haven't come out internally. Forget what's happening externally. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, that's
their
very
most important
interesting.
Stakeholder, their employees, they have not addressed it with them. And so now to your point, they're going to run with your employer brand perception is now already out of your hands because you haven't actually talked to your most important stakeholder. And they're now with their microphone on social media talking about how they feel.
So, yeah, so that does cut both ways. If you're a prospective candidate, look for the signals. But if you're an employer, make sure that you're managing those internal customers.
Yeah, absolutely.
I like that. We also talked about some more sort of apathetic bosses in your life.
Oh, yes.
Because there's the flame-throwing Medusa, but then there are other boss scenarios that a lot of people are struggling with in teams right now. Where would you go on that example?
I'm going to go with the napper,
yeah.
which my mom remembers the napper. I call my mom every day. She has the receipts. Somebody's like, somebody said to me on a podcast recently, that didn't really happen. This person didn't really fall asleep in almost every large and small meeting. I said, you can call my mother. She remembers. Like, it's true. And so it's okay. So you're thinking, gosh, this person really fell asleep in every meeting. So as we had talked about, I said, I had empathy. I thought, why is he constantly falling asleep? Is he narcoleptic? Does he have a substance abuse problem? Is he in a fight with his partner? Is he not sleeping in his bed on the floor? What is going on?
Yeah.
And then I'll never forget. There's a day we have cubicles, like low cubicles. He's next to me. He's taking calls, Dane, from recruiters at his desk.
Open plan.
And openly, and I find out how much he makes. And I'm like, oh no, I can't believe he makes this much more than me. And he does nothing. But this is disengagement.
Yeah.
And disengagement can spread like wildfire. And it's the famous quote, your culture becomes defined by the worst behavior you tolerate. And I don't understand why leaders don't intervene. Talk about courage. It's like, do we have the courage to face that head on?
Yeah.
Or do we let that person consistently nap, which happened for far too long? I still ask myself, I know exactly who that VP was. And I'm like, why didn't she help him move on sooner? It was the worst kept secret in the organization.
Yeah, it's fascinating when you see that. And it is common, I think, with all of the particularly with all the middle manager burnout that's gone on right now, there's a lot of organizations where a senior leader sits there and says, I know so-and-so isn't really, you know, carrying their load right now, but they're critical to me for this part of my work. It might be 4 hours of that leader's time every week. And they're like, I'm not going to let them go because it would be hard for me to replace them, even though I'm getting suboptimal results from them.
But you know what's happening? You're getting suboptimal results from everyone else too.
Yeah, that,
yep. Because you're watching the person disengaged who's allowed to stay. So then Dane, the high performer, says, what does it matter? If he gets to stay and he's sleeping half the time, then what does it matter what I do? That's what people don't get.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And it reminds me of, you know, people talk about Pareto talent. You know, you're going to get 20% of your team's going to deliver 80% of the results. There's a real danger in that, because there's some truth to getting really great high performers. But the danger is, if you're only focusing on your 20% of performers, then you are, going back to your point, you're accepting a lot of bad behaviors in the culture, and that has to bite over time.
Absolutely. And so I had a boss years ago who taught me this, which was that when someone is struggling in their job, either to perform the skills of the job, and they could have not been trained properly, it could not be the right fit, all those things, not onboarded, or they're disengaged completely, it is time for you to do the coffee, do the lunch, have the phone call, take them out, and ask them what's going on. And Michael Murphy of Harvard University has this question I included in Double Emails at Midnight that I love. It's like, what would it take for you to be excited to be at work again? And it's this idea of, tell me what's going on, how can I help, and can this person recommit? So if I can't recommit working for you, then you need to help me move on. I'm meant to do great things, just not on your team. And I have to move on. And that's, again, back to the courage,
great
right? Like, using words. But it's like, can't we just have the courage to, like, we watch these things happen. That, and the napper's one example. Over and over in my career, I call it the downward spiral of this person. And you watch it happen and you're like, why won't anyone intervene? And in most of those cases, yes, a peer can check in, but it is the boss who has the power, and it's a reporting structure to have that intervention. Yeah. I wish more people would do it.
Yeah, I do too. So again, it's a great call to action for bosses to be having that courage, whether it's going and asking them to do the self-work. I love that question of what would it take for you to get excited about, you know, being here at work again. It's positively framed. It's not attacking. It's not accusatory. Yeah. It's great. That's really neat. And I think there was one of your approaches there in the book around mirroring, which really played with me. Could you share that?
And I do that often. I've done this often in my career, particularly when I'm coaching leaders, particularly when we're talking about the toxic ones that are tough to coach, is that, can you be a mirror for somebody? So we all have feelings about things, but can we stick to the facts, right? So if I'm meeting with you, and you're not going to be napping on the job, but let's say, Dane, you're just a little disengaged. So we're going to go out for coffee, and I'm going to say, I just want to check in to see how you're doing. I noticed that you haven't come to any of the team meetings in the last few weeks. I noticed that you've been coming in a little later, and you haven't been speaking up as much in our one-on-ones. And is there anything I can do to be helping you? So do you see what I did? Like, it's not that I'm, yes, I'm pissed that you haven't come to the team meetings. Yes, I'm watching the clock. And why is he coming in at 11 every day? But I'm taking the feelings out, and I'm just acting like a video recorder. Imagine if I had recorded you on video.
Yeah.
What are the things that I have seen, just calmly? And then an invitation for you to share and my offer to help. And so two things are going to happen. Either you're going to be like, you're going to see that mirror and you're going to say, wow, like, someone's actually calling me out on the things I've been struggling with. And it's going to be like the balloon pops and you're going to share.
Yeah.
And we're going to have a path forward. Or the mirror is held up and you're going to say, I don't care.
Yeah.
Like, I'm so disengaged or stuff's happening that I don't feel comfortable. I don't trust Mita. I'm not going to tell her anything.
Yeah.
So in that case, it's likely that that person will have to move on if they're not willing to work through or share what they're going through. There's only so much you can do as a boss in that case.
Yeah, that makes sense. I think that's why that mirror concept really worked for me, because I also listened to a podcast with Marcus Buckingham where he said judgment is such a just destructive force in teams, even in performance reviews. So if you can mirror the facts and not the feelings, then you give them a chance to see it, to recognize it, and to act. Yeah. It's very cool, really powerful. So, you know, as you look forward to going right back to the beginning, fixing what's broken in the workplace, it's a huge undertaking. There's lots of workplaces. None are really built the same. What is it that excites you about this moment, this opportunity for us to be being more intentional about how we lead and how we build teams?
what excites me is the massive amounts of disruption.
Yes.
Because it's going to make us reconsider so many things. You know, the race to embrace AI and all the things AI will help scale and automate. Where does that lead? Where does that leave a human like me? Yeah. Well, I'm not an AI agent. I need to lead into being human.
Yeah.
You know, I hope AI doesn't generate or breed a generation of lazy bosses, because then you actually should have time to do all the things we're talking about, to spend time with your teams, to coach, teach, train,
yeah,
some of the things that AI can't do. And so I'm actually excited about the disruptions. I think that's where innovation comes in, some of these really tough conversations of like, I hate the future of work, which sounds so cliche, yeah, but what does work look like today and tomorrow? I mean, it forces you in a way that you wouldn't have maybe before.
Correct.
Because now all these things are just changing the way we think about how we work together.
Yeah, I agree. And I think the future of work as a theme and as a thesis has become very much about leverage. You know, how are we going to leverage this? How are we going to leverage that? It hasn't been about human outcomes.
Yes.
In what I've seen. And I think that's what I'm hearing from you.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
And what's what I like about that, Mita, is that, yes, we're going to have the opportunity to lean in and be human. So there's this kind of soundbite going out there. You're not going to be replaced by AI. You're going to be replaced by a human that uses AI well. I'm hearing a different soundbite from you. It's more like you're not going to be replaced by a human using AI. You're going to be replaced by a human who uses human.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, yeah. I mean, what is my competitive advantage against an AI agent?
Yeah, that's it.
It's my heart. It's my soul. It's what makes me human, right? And so I'm going to really lean into that. And you look at, you know, Bill Gates coming out not too long ago, and he's one of many prominent leaders who've talked about what jobs will still exist in AI. And listen, anything with the human touch, it's not surprising that healthcare is one. You know, interesting, I was talking to someone like a mortgage broker. Mortgage broker? Yeah, that's one of the most important decisions of my life. I don't want to delegate that to a bot, right? And so think about these moments in our lives where it's like, you want like that hand on your shoulder.
Yeah.
You want just that feeling of care and the human touch. Those are, I mean, and there's plenty, I think, there's still plenty of opportunity for us to be making impact in that way.
I think so too. And I guess what intrigues me is that if we're all going to be doing more coaching, teaching, training as humans, particularly as good leaders, where do you get inspiration, or where do you see people learning more of those tools? Obviously, they can read your book, but are there other ways for them to be, you know, upskilling themselves in some of those capabilities?
I mean, gosh, there's so much content. Yeah. Your podcast, so many podcasts, so many things, so many places and spaces. But you know what? I want people to get offline more and enjoy their lives. We were talking about you're taking your kids to the beach.
Yeah.
I'm like coloring with my children, going for walks, spending time being offline, because that's when we can think and we can be creative. It's all of a sudden now like, quiet is a luxury. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
Like if you can actually go offline and do things that spark joy and creativity, that's when you're going to start to think about really big questions you want to tackle. You're going to come up with creative problems and solutions. And so that's my biggest piece of advice, is actually just go offline and do nothing.
Yeah. I love that. Well, it's been a wonderful conversation, Mita.
Thank you.
I've very different from what we shared on stage at Transform.
Yes.
And really loved a lot of the perspectives you've shared here today around story and community, around the impact bosses have on our lives. 2/3 of us, it's the biggest impact. I thought that's a huge stat. I love those three moments where the bad boss behaviors show up, whether it's a marketplace, a trickle-down issue from a boss above, or a personal moment. I think that gives us all a really good diagnostic or dashboard indicator. And coming back to culture, you know, fear kills culture, or the worst behaviors that you allow. I think some of the bad boss examples, some of the methods like mirroring that you share, just allow all of us to come out there and say, hey, how can I be a little bit more intentional? And I just think that closing note's super important. You know, let's all be more human, but let's take a bit of offline time so that we can be ready to be intentional and bring our best energy forward.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for having me. I hope everyone can check out The Devil Emails at Midnight, What Good Leaders Can Learn from Bad Bosses. And thanks again for being an early reader.
You bet. How do they best find your books and content?
You can find the book on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, your local independent bookstore. I love meeting people on LinkedIn. Follow me there, and mitamalik.com.
Excellent. Thanks, Mita.
Just a quick note before we go. The views and opinions shared in this episode are those of our guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the host, Dane Gruneveld, the Leader Group, our patron Huddle 3, or our partners and affiliates. Any scenarios discussed are for the purpose of fueling creative thinking and conversation and should be viewed only in this context. Dane, Leader, our sponsors, partners, and affiliates do not endorse any guest or any organization they may be associated with. It's important to remember that every workplace is as individual as the people within it. Our recommendation is to always seek solutions that are specifically designed to help serve your team's unique needs. And to this point, please know we're here, ready to help you find the best way forward, no matter where your starting point is. You can connect with Dane or myself, Alicia McCraw, on LinkedIn or via the links contained in the show notes. Thanks again for tuning in. And hey, if you think someone in your network would benefit from this episode, feel free to share it or give us a 5-star rating. Those 5 little stars really help us reach more curious people like you. We'll catch you next time on the Future of Teamwork.